Well, it's lovely to be discussing this subject in Scotland, since the idea of happiness was invented here, or at least the idea that the goal of society should be the happiness of the people. Incredibly, I think actually the most important idea in the world in the modern period. I have always been a true believer in this since I first read about it as an undergraduate. And one of the things I've done is to co-found a movement called Action for Happiness. I won't go on about it, but it is a movement to create a happier society. And when we founded it 5 years ago, we interviewed candidates for the director, and one of them had gone into the web to see if there was any other organization on the web, World Wide Web, that had the word happiness in its title. And the answer that came back on his screen was, "Your search for happiness has produced no results." Well, this is a very serious situation. This is partly why this is such an important meeting. And we obviously have to do better. And one of the key things is, of course, to have better ways of preventing misery developing in adolescence. And I found these two surveys incredibly helpful and informative. And I want to come back to adolescence just a bit later on, but I've been asked to start with a bit of a wider context. So I put my slides together yesterday, and of course when I got on the train, I realised that I haven't started with the right person. I should have started with Hutchison. But this is the person I've... Oh, what's going on here? Sorry. Oh.
It works on the keyboard.
I'm sorry? Okay. Oh, perhaps I've touched that by mistake. Where am I now? Anyway, look, let me... There, that was where I started. So, of course, he was just a pupil of the Scottish Enlightenment, but a rather important one. Let me move to the present day, and I've already revealed I was going to have a quiz. Who is the leading champion of this idea in the modern world? Quite surprisingly, this lady. She has had a huge national consultation throughout 2015 involving 50 meetings, public meetings with government ministers and the public, and I think about 2,000 town hall meetings on the subject of what matters to us. And the report is about to reach us, but it hasn't reached us yet. But I think that is a wonderful question, and I actually went to a seminar where various of us tried to give our answers to that. But what a great thing to do, to have a national consultation on that subject. Worldwide, I suppose the OECD is the biggest pusher of this idea, and they have now got Britain first, but now nearly every OECD country has an official measurement of the well-being of its population. But the person in Britain who has pushed this most is our former Cabinet Secretary, Gus O'Donnell. So he chaired a committee that I was also a member of. Another member was Angus Deaton, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics last year, and the chief statistician of OECD and the head of the Nudge Unit in the Cabinet Office. And I just wanted to tell you that our sort of two of our key conclusions. I mean, one is just to reaffirm what Hutchison said. But I think the modern view would be not, for example, Bentham's view that you just add up the happiness of everybody, but you want to give particular weight to the absence of misery when you evaluate the outcome of a policy or the state of a nation. And then the other issue, of course, is how we are to, what is our concept of happiness? And we argued strongly that a democratic concept of happiness is one where you let the person, each person, evaluate their own happiness. You don't, as it were, measure 10 different things about them, do they think their life is worthwhile? How anxious are they? Are they getting on with their mother-in-law? And then put weights. You just let the individual make his or her own judgment as to how satisfied overall they are with their life these days. This is a question that's been asked more than any other question in this field. So we know quite a lot about it, and that's that's the concept which we recommended. So let me just tell you a few things which our group at LSE have been finding out about the determination of the life satisfaction of the population, based on mainly on the British cohort study of people born in 1970. So you know everything about them from birth onwards. And you can look at how satisfied they are as adults in relation to their current adult situation, or you can, of course, predict it from their adolescence or even from their earlier childhood. So let's do those three in turn. I thought it'd be more interesting to do the probability of being dissatisfied with your life. But the weights are very similar if you do the whole range. But I think these are quite surprising. They're not what members of my party in Parliament would put as in the order that they come from these numbers here. So poverty is not actually the main cause of misery in our society. Unemployment is a very important cause. Poor education these are all put in simultaneously. So poor education, holding income constant is not a big problem. A lot of people being on their own is a problem. This is the whole population of all ages. Illness, physical illness, is a problem, and this is including all those old people. But the biggest problem by far is mental illness. Now, if we now go back and say instead, what's explaining the... I muddled you. This table here is based on the whole population of all ages. Now I'm going to give you a table based on the British cohort study of people born in 1970 and asked, if we go back to when a person is 16, what features of their development best predict whether they will be satisfied with their life in middle age? So the three main dimensions, I suppose, of child development are intellectual, behavioural and emotional. I'm sure you now know which one of those is the most important. And it's not intellectual. So academic performance, and what we say, you know, you'll regret it if you don't sacrifice everything for your test scores, is not a very good predictor of whether a person will have a satisfied adult life. The best predictor is how their emotional health is. And of course, that is not surprising given what I just showed you, that obviously poor emotional health at age 16 is a pretty good predictor of mental health later in life, which is a very good predictor of life satisfaction later in life. So I'm just giving you a bit of armoury, I hope, to use when you're making your case to your commissioners or whoever else is spending money to spend some more money on mental health. Now we could go even further back. We could say, what's the best predictors of emotional health at age 16? And these are also surprising to, I think, the members of my party in Parliament, because they're so used to looking at the right-hand column. What are the great predictors of academic performance? Yes, poverty is a tremendously bad thing in terms of your subsequent academic performance. Whereas, for example, your mother's mental health has very little effect on it. But if we're talking about why are some people much more emotionally healthy at 16 than others? The mother's mental health is coming through very strongly, and the family income is very much weaker. The other thing we did, now this is based on yet a third survey, which is the survey which was done in the county of Avon, of all the children born there in 1991 to 93. It's amazing that the variation in school quality within one county could be so large as to contribute this huge amount to the emotional health of children at age 16. And it's particularly extraordinary that the primary school could be having such an effect. If you ask me how is the school quality measured, it's just measured by the name of the school. But this is the variation in emotional health at age 16 of children who've just been to different schools, picking up the effect of each school. That's quite remarkable, and I think every school teacher should realise what they're doing, not only for the academic outcome of their children in the second column, but also for the emotional health of their children in the previous column. So that's just some background. Now, what can we do about all of this? Prevention is one thing, and we've had two wonderful talks about that. The other, of course, is as soon as somebody shows that they're in trouble, you can have a clinical intervention and treatment. So since we've heard about prevention, and I'll come back to that, but let me start with treatment. So here in the first column are the prevalence rates of mental illness, clinically significant mental illness at different ages. But the shocking thing is the fact that only about a quarter of people who have these problems are in treatment. And that is what is some people call the mental health gap. WHO are always talking about the mental health gap, but it is one of the most shocking things about the healthcare systems of every country. We are no worse than anybody else. But it's deeply shocking that whereas you have a relatively small physical problem, it will, in well over three quarters of the cases, normally be in treatment. And you're talking about a quarter if it's a mental health problem. So, and this is true actually also for adults of all ages. So just to give you a bit of history, when I had finished writing a book on happiness, I thought, what can I do that would be the most useful? And I thought, well, this is deeply shocking. And so with the help of David Clark, the wonderful clinical psychology professor at Oxford, we got the Labour government in 2005 manifesto to commit itself to, quotes, improving access to psychological therapy, which spells the awful name IAPT, I-A-P-T, improving access to psychological therapy. And we got a programme off the ground for adults, because it was really, unless you were in danger of killing somebody or yourself, there was no access to anything except pills, roughly speaking, in 2005. So we got the adult programme started first. But then from 2011 onwards, there's also been a program for children and young people where the situation was not initially so bad, because there was always the child and adolescent mental health services. But the task there has been to increase access, number one, and number two, to improve the quality. So let me say a little about this is England, of course, but I'll just tell you a little about our children and young people, and then our adult programme. So, I'm not quite sure whether some of the money has come to Scotland as well, but we got a promise from the last coalition government in its last gasp to increase access from a quarter to a third. So that's actually a big challenge. And there's quite a big training program going on now. But the equally big challenge is to improve the quality, because most of what was going on in child and adolescent mental health services, in England at least, was not based on NICE recommended approaches. Let me not say any more. So the aim now is to get well-proven therapies with a decent evidence base in place throughout the country. So for anxiety, it would be mainly CBT. For conduct disorder, mild to moderate conduct disorder, it would be parent training, which has had been found to have extraordinarily long-lived effects. They've been followed up now for 7 or 8 years with well-maintained effects on the children. For the more serious cases, family therapy face-to-face. For depression, interpersonal therapy or CBT. Personality disorder, dialectical behaviour therapy, and so on. So the aim is to get the NICE recommended treatments universal, and then to know what you're achieving. And it is deeply shocking that in most mental health services, until recently, there's been no measurement of outcomes. And not surprising in a way, therefore they're underfunded, because commissioners, how can they know what's being achieved with their money? So it's bad from the obviously a political point of view, not to measure the outcomes, but it's also not good from the point of view of the conduct of the therapy. You should know in some clear way that you can see by comparison how your patient or the child you're trying to help is changing. So the aim there is to get universal outcome measurement by 2020. In the adult IAPT, we've had outcome measurement from the very beginning in nearly every person who's been treated with a measurement at the beginning of every that the person comes along with at the beginning of every session, questionnaire filled in, so that you can see how they've done, and if they don't come in, you know how they were last time. So we've got an outcome measurement for dropouts, very important. A huge upward bias in the claims of psychological therapists because they don't know what happened to the dropouts. we know what happened to our dropouts, and the adult IAPT is achieving 50% recovery rates during the period of treatment. Let me just show you a little more about it. One of the measurements is what percentage of that diagnosable population is seen by IAP. That's how the target of access is defined. And they saw 15% in 2015, and we have a commitment to 25% by 2020. So hopefully we can get all these people who are just offered pills and nothing else to be offered something which will have a longer lasting effect on their well-being. But I mention in particular, because it's relevant to adolescents, the focus in this expansion will be heavily on maternal depression, so much of which is untreated, and problems of comorbid physical and mental health, which are also so undertreated. Now, one of the interesting things which was mentioned, I think, by the first report we had, is the importance in the world we're moving into of digital treatments. And they must be particularly powerful for younger people, for whom that's the world that they inhabit, unlike people like me. And there are now being developed some very powerful digital treatment, digital versions of, for example, various types in particular of CBT. I could have put up a couple that I'm aware of for young people, but let me just mention, because I was so astonished by this, David Clark, the colleague that I mentioned, he's an expert in social anxiety disorder or social phobia, which is an incredibly inhibiting condition and extraordinarily amenable to treatment. And the effects are permanent. These anxiety conditions, most of them, if a person recovers, they recover forever. So he has a treatment face-to-face, which would take 10 or 12 sessions, which has over 75% recovery rate. But to my astonishment, he has now produced and tested a digital version of it with some therapist support, but about a quarter the amount of time of a therapist that would be employed in a face-to-face treatment, which has exactly the same recovery rate. Some people, of course, who are shy, prefer to do it online to get started. But they get the support either digitally or telephonically from the therapist as well. And it's achieving these absolutely extraordinary results. And I've no doubt that he's going to be modifying this for younger people. Well, actually, that's not quite true. I asked him. He thinks it would work with younger people. It hasn't been trialled on them, but pretty much as it is with adolescents. There's so much to be done to improve the treatment situation. So let me now come on to the prevention issue. So if we start with schools, these are sort of things which we are campaigning for, and we had a meeting with Nicky Morgan, who unfortunately, when she was coming to visit our school, where we run this trial called Healthy Minds Curriculum. Unfortunately, it happened to be the day she was removed from office. These things happen. But anyway, we're pushing for well-being to become an absolutely established goal of schools. Of course, this is England, rather, but I don't know your comparable situation quite. How can we really change the situation in schools? We think unless we measure well-being, it's going to be very difficult to offset the exam culture. We are urging the development of a well-being tool. It will have to be trialled very carefully, which would be a mark of the value added. The school could record the well-being value added as well as the academic value added of all its children. And of course, it would learn a lot about its children, because particularly the children with emotional problems as opposed to behavioural problems, not always identified by their teachers as having those problems. Then we want a well-being code, which is debated and signed up and so on. But I just wanted to say a little about this curriculum issue, because I have become involved in this in two stages. So first, I thought, why don't we try and take one of the most famous of these interventions and try it in Britain. So I took the so-called Penn Resilience Programme, developed by Martin Seligman, that some of you may know of, the originator of so-called positive psychology. And we trialled it in about 20 schools. But it's an 18-hour programme. So actually, I wasn't surprised that the effect was small and faded quite quickly. And it's quite obvious, I think, that that many of these interventions that we are studying have been deliberately small, because nobody had any money or any clout, and they thought, well, goodness, if we can grab these children for 10 hours, you know, that'll be a triumph, and we've only got so much money and so much time ourselves. The whole thing is on such a shoestring, our attention to these problems, which is one of the reasons why the surveys that we've heard about are finding it difficult to find effective interventions. The interventions are too small. So we thought we must at least use what we have in England. I don't know what you have in Scotland, but in England, most schools have a one-hour personal, social and health education slot per week. Let's use that for something evidence-based rather than whatever rubbish is typically going on at the moment. So we wrote down the list of topics. So here's a list of topics. Resilience, compassion, sex, drugs, alcohol, mental disorders, parenting, media awareness, life goals, and mindfulness. Let's take these topics and let's find the best successfully trialed modules that have been done and put them together into a four-year curriculum. And these are the names of the programs that we eventually identified have had to modify them a little, but basically we've constructed a curriculum out of that and we are trying it out in 26 schools. The teachers, of course, have to be trained. And the reason why some of the interventions, I don't know, for example, if SEAL was one of the interventions that you looked at, but the SEAL social and emotional aspects of learning trial in England, which was initiated by the Labour government, was judged to have absolutely no effect on anything in the trial, because it was not. There was no teaching of no training of the teachers to teach it, and it was not sufficiently structured. And of course, these evidence-based interventions that work are very highly structured and manualized. So the teachers or the therapists have to be treated in the same way as surgeons. You don't just say, you know, find your way around, open the person up and find your way around. It's got to be done in a manualized way. And then how do you deal if this problem arises? What do you do if this problem arises? What do you do? These are the successful interventions. They're very, very detailed in the way in which they have been developed and tried out. And this has got to be the way forward. The well-intentioned person just trying out some general idea is not going to be the answer for any of these problems. So let's hope. Now, we're in the middle of this trial, so I can't tell you any results of it. But I'm hoping that we can produce a proper curriculum that people, teachers could be trained to teach, and that we could have in schools, secondary schools in particular, a specialism in PSHE or wellbeing or whatever you like to call it, where there would be in every secondary school at least one person whose prime specialty was that. But of course, there would be other teachers teaching the subject, but they would be under some guidance from that teacher. And I think, you know, what we want to have in our schools, of course, is some missionaries. We need missionaries for happiness in our schools. And if we had a specialty, those would be the missionaries. They would, incidentally, be mainly psychology graduates who are, and this is the subject attracting some of the very best undergraduate students these days, to have some of them in our schools would be transformative. So that's the way that's got to go. I'll do very quick now. Other aspects of prevention, of course, interventions on parents. I'm very, very keen that we have parent training. The Cowan and Cowan program has had good evaluations in the US. I want to see it tried in Britain. And, of course, the best prevention of all is work. And I am a great believer in guaranteeing apprenticeships or pre-apprenticeships to every young person who doesn't want to go to university. I think I should draw to a close then, but I just want to show you a little bit of advertisement. This is the book where you can find most of the things that I've said by David Clark and myself. And I do think that we can move into a much better place, and to some extent we are moving into an age when people are more psychologically aware. Surveys show that, more mentally health aware. I think this is happening actually largely due to the greater influence of women in our national life. And the obstacle, of course, is Puritanism. I believe that's quite well developed north of the border. but let me end with the definition of it by the American writer H.L. Mencken. Puritanism, the haunting fear that someone somewhere may be happy. I think we can defeat the Puritans. Thank you.